achievements were in some ways greater than I thought, but that his fall from power before he accomplished what he set out to do was more tragic than I had imagined.
Coming up on In Contrast, Gorbachev, His Life and Times with William Taubman. I'm Ilan Stavans, and In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions. William Taubman is a professor emeritus of political science at Amherst College. His biography of Nikita Khrushchev won the Pulitzer Prize in 2004. His latest book is Gorbachev, His Life and Times. William Taubman, a pleasure having you in Contrast. Let me start by asking you to choose two or three words, whichever words you want, to describe Gorbachev. Just in those words, what would they be?
A hero, but a tragic hero, and mostly because that is both the tragedy and the heroism stem from his remarkable self-confidence and optimism.
It is the polar opposite, the heroic and the tragic that come together in this individual. In starting to write the biography that took you over a decade to put together, did you arrive with the preconception of those two extremes, the tragic and the heroic, or did they come to you as the process of research in drafting the manuscript?
I thought very highly of him when I began. I'm not sure I would have used the word heroic to describe him, and I certainly would not have used the word tragic, even though I knew things did not end well. So in that sense, as I worked, I realized that his achievements were in some ways greater than I thought, but that his fall from power before he accomplished what he set out to do was more tragic than I had imagined.
This is your second biography. You have written or edited other books before, but in this scope, with the ambition, the previous one being about Nikita Khrushchev, do you go through a series of emotions as you are doing the exploration and the research? I'm thinking of ambivalence maybe throughout the subject of your biography, a certain need to distance and a certain closeness depending on the time. What are the ranges of emotions that a biographer like you, tackling major Soviet figures, goes through?
Well, I have to admit that I chose both subjects, thinking that of all the Soviet leaders that one could have written about, these were two who had tried to do good things, that they were, in a sense, admirable in their aims. But I also got frustrated as I worked on them to discover some of the bad things they'd done, especially in the case of Khrushchev, who had blood, as he put it, up to his elbows, if not armpits. And in the case of both of them, they managed not only to obtain power and to do a great many things, good and not so good, but they were self-destructive. There were many times when they undermined themselves and their cause. And I was increasingly frustrated by that because I guess I identified, at least with their hopes to do what was admirable. I identified, and in both cases, I found myself writing what I regarded afterwards, as I looked back, as kind of nasty needles. I was also trying to write vividly, but in both cases, when I showed my manuscript to other readers, friends and colleagues, they pointed out that I was perhaps unfair and that there was a kind of negative tone when it wasn't justified. And especially in the case of Gorbachev, this was true. And I reached that conclusion. I went back and I modified those remarks because I thought, indeed, they were too nasty.
Did you set out to be a biographer early on in your career? Did you stumble upon this literary form? Tell me about you and biography.
Stumble is exactly the right word. I never set out to do biography, although, you know, interestingly, looking back, my senior thesis at Harvard was about Nikolai Bukharin, who was one of Stalin's associates and close collaborators, and then Stalin liquidated him. So I'm slightly amazed when I look back to see that at that early stage, I had chosen to write about a Soviet leader. But then I got distracted by many things, including what I came to understand as the demands of political science, which was my subject, my specialty in graduate school and in teaching. And so I didn't return to biography until the 1980s. I had written a book called Stalin's American Policy, which was not biography. It was really about U.S.-Soviet relations under Stalin. And then for my next project, I decided I would do Khrushchev's American Policy. And I was stumbling along, not getting very far. The archives weren't available in the Soviet Union. And so I decided to propose it to my publisher, W.W. Norton. And they didn't take it. They said no. But they said, if you would do a biography of Khrushchev, we would be very interested. So I said I would, even though I'd never done one before. I'd never tried to do one before. I hadn't even read that many biographies. But ever since then, I've been a biographer.
Tell me, what is a bad biographer and what is a good biographer? Or maybe a bad biography and a good biography for a person who came late to the forum, who responded to a petition from a publisher, and who just, as you said it, probably had not read that many biographies before. Where does a biographer come short? Is a biographer's biggest challenges? And where does a biographer really shine?
Well, I have perhaps a particular view of this, which may indeed reflect my earlier work as a political scientist, becoming in effect a historian and then a biographer. First of all, I think context is very important. That is, you're trying to understand a person. The person is at the center of your research and your writing and your thought. But you have to understand the context. Otherwise, you don't get the whole picture. And I had been teaching Soviet politics, Soviet history for years and years in my courses and writing about it in different ways. So I went out of my way, and that came naturally, to try to establish the context in which my hero is operating. And the second thing was that I got interested in psychology. I taught a course at Amherst for about 10 years with a psychologist, and the subject of the course was personality and political leadership. And we read together theories of personality, and with our students we read biographies and psychobiographies. And I quickly understood that psychobiographies could be mischievous. It was too easy to reduce the person you're trying to understand to toilet training, you know, or some other feature, some syndrome that you thought you had identified. So I could see the problems, but I emphasized in my own work what I had learned in my reading and my teaching of that course. And the way that worked was that when I would come across a behavior on the part of my subject that was puzzling and I couldn't figure out in any other way, it wasn't explained by circumstance, it wasn't explained by political competition, it seemed to come from somewhere, but I didn't know where. At that point, I found it very helpful to have worked on psychology. And so I considered both my Khrushchev and my Gorbachev book not psychobiographies. I'm not qualified to do them. I'm not a psychologist. But I consider them psychologically informed biographies. And I hope that I was able to understand them better as a result of coming at them in this way.
There is training for a historian. I'm thinking of graduate school, undergraduate school. As well, there is training for, certainly for a political scientist or for a psychologist. But there is far less training, if any, for a biographer. We don't train students, undergraduates or graduates, to become biographers. Most biographers say that they came to biography from other means. They could be, as you said, psychology or sociology or some novelists that write biographies. Do you think that as a teacher, there should be more of training or a path for students to embrace the form of biography as a discipline?
Well, you know, I'm not giving it that much thought, although now thinking back, in effect, that's what we were doing in this course on personality and leadership. We were reading biographies. We were asking our students to write mini biographies of political leaders. So yes, I think it is a good idea. I mean, it's a natural studying, trying to understand individual people is fascinating in life and in one's work. I think one of the obstacles to doing it is the fact that it has become so fashionable in history, less so in political science, perhaps in political science too. I mean, the focus is often on what you might call impersonal forces, social movements, economic conditions in diplomatic history, the nature of the international system. And I think there is a kind of tendency to dismiss biography on the part of many scholars as something that verges on quote-unquote journalism, that word spoken with a sneer. So I think this is a surprisingly controversial subject.
I want to go to Gorbachev, but I want to ask you one more question about the art of biography. And that question needs a little context, as you were saying. The translators talk of two different strategies when approaching a text. They say that they either disappear and become invisible, that the purpose of a translation and of a translator that produces that translation is to disappear, not to be noticed, that the translation is presented in such an effortless way as to make the reader feel that it is an original, that it was written in this language. And then there is the opposite view, perhaps personified by Nabokov, who wanted translations and translators to be very visible, that a translation should not hide the fact that this was coming from another language, from another culture, and there are all sorts of roadblocks and obstacles. What is the position that a biographer should have? Should the biographer disappear after doing the context and after doing the research and all the interviews and let the subject become a narrative? Should the biographer, on the other hand, be visible, even in almost invisible ways, putting his or her fingerprints throughout? What do you say?
Well, I have what may strike you as a paradoxical answer. I think the biographer should try to be invisible, but that's totally impossible because the work is the work of the writer. And the arc of the work, if you're able to construct one, is created by the writer. Now, if that's the case, one might very well ask, well, then why shouldn't you be honest and come out and make much of that? Because I think then the focus shifts to you and in a way, it's self-display. I think the distinction that is often used as do you tell your story or do you show it? Do you tell or do you show? My preference is for showing rather than telling. Obviously, in a book, in a biography, there are plenty of moments and they need to be there where your voice is speaking for you. But I think for the most part, it's better to let the story tell itself through the words of your subject and the people who work with him or her and the sources, the memoirs, and all the rest. So that's what I've tried to do. But even as I do it, I don't delude myself into thinking that I have disappeared. So that, I think, is the paradoxical answer to your very good question.
Let's delve directly into the book, the biography of Mikhail Gorbachev that you wrote. The subtitle is His Life and Times. And from the beginning to the very end, you stress the ambivalence, the fact that this is a character that is very hard to decipher, that at moments is very clear what he's after, and at moments he is very unclear even to himself, and that this ambivalence or this hidden and revealed aspect are elements that you found throughout the entire book. You also say that this is not an official biography, that you did not write to Gorbachev and ask permission to write a biography, that instead you told him that you were going to write one and wanted to see if he would help you in different ways. In what way would this book have been different had you set out to do an official biography?
Well, the reason I didn't ask his permission, which would have made it an official authorized biography, is he might have said no, and that would have changed it entirely. Then I would have done it against his expressed wish, and I would have had to find people entirely on my own to talk to and get...
In other words, had he said no, you would still have gone forward.
I think so. Yeah. I think so, but it would have been an unauthorized biography and perhaps even an opposed biography, opposed by the man himself. Once he agreed to support it, I felt I was in the best position because if I'd asked his permission and he'd said yes to that, then I would have felt beholden to him in a way that I didn't as I worked. And I would have worried, perhaps we can talk about that, more than I did about his reaction to it. But I felt in the end I was in the best possible position because he had agreed to support it, but he had not given me permission. He was helping me, but I was not beholden to him in the way I would have been otherwise. And so I proceeded in that way. And he did support it in various ways.
Throughout. And as you mentioned in the book, not only did he grant you a number of lengthy interviews, you visited him numerous times. Also, you talked to his affiliates. The difference between writing about Khrushchev and Gorbachev is that one subject is alive and the other one is not. In what sense, when writing a book that even unofficial as this one is, you get the sense that the subject is behind you or sitting on one of your shoulders, overseeing and controlling, or that you might step over an aspect that he doesn't like?
Well, that is there. In the case of Khrushchev, I was helped immensely by his son and his daughter, and they helped me more than Gorbachev did personally. For example, Sergei Khrushchev, Khrushchev's son, and his wife took me to Khrushchev's native village. They took me to Donetsk, now in Ukraine, and warred over. At that point, it was part of the Soviet Union, and took me around to see places he had lived and introduced me to people. So in a sense, they had a claim, and they exercised it. I remember vividly the moment when I was done with my manuscript, and Sergei Khrushchev had not asked to see it, but I felt I had to show it to him because he'd been so helpful to me. So I gave it to him, and he read it, and we spoke on the phone for 2 hours. And the first hour was he corrected factual errors in my manuscript, and I was grateful for that. The second hour was he argued with my conclusions. But at the end of that hour, he said, I have come to realize, he now lives in this country and has for a long time, that if I don't agree with your conclusions, I should write my own book. And he did.
He did. Yeah.
And I admired him greatly for that. I hadn't expected that. Now, in Gorbachev's case, he doesn't read English. So although I've sent him a copy of the book, he hasn't read it. He's waiting for the Russian translation, which is coming out this year. What he will do at that point, I don't know. I think that a man who has accomplished so much for his country but is despised in it by most Russians probably has a deep need for, I won't say hagiography, but for a book which praises him. And my book does praise him, but it is also critical. And so I don't know what he's going to say. And as you said, as I worked, he was, in a sense, on my shoulder, looking over my shoulder. But I tried to put that out of my mind and tell the story as best I could.
You are brilliant in describing the path of this young man who eventually is selected for this major role as leader against all odds. The success of Gorbachev is found in him bringing down his own position, the power that he had, and the whole country, the Soviet Union, the constellation of countries. The triumph is the defeat, or vice versa. You call him one of the major, if not the major, leader of the 20th century, certainly the one that transformed the world entirely in dramatic ways. How could he have reached that high a job with so many intrigues and the maneuvers? In retrospect, and I'm asking you here not to be a biographer, but a speculator in history, what is it that happened for him to have ended up in that position?
This is perhaps the key. Gorbachev and his wife credited most for his rise to the top Yuri Andropov, who for a long time was the KGB chief of the secret police of the Soviet system, and then briefly before he died, the leader. This is a man who sent people to prison, who sent dissidents to insane asylums where they were filled with drugs that would sort of calm them down, quote unquote. This was a man who had a lot of evil that he did, and yet he raised this good man, Gorbachev, to the top. So maybe that's the way to get at this. Why did he do it? What did he see in Gorbachev as a representative of the Soviet system that ended up putting Gorbachev on the throne of that system and allowing him to be the gravedigger of that system? Oddly enough, I think Andropov and some of the other leaders saw Gorbachev as a kind of ideal product of communism, what they wanted communism to produce. The Soviets had a phrase for that, the new Soviet man. Supposedly they were producing them, but of course they were producing relatively few of them, especially under Stalin. But Gorbachev seemed to be intelligent. He was obviously educated. He was enterprising. He was thoughtful. He was incorruptible in comparison to the legions of the corrupt in the Soviet bureaucracy. My wife, Jane, who taught Russian at Amherst for many years, and I did all of the interviews together, when we were in Stavropol, which is where Gorbachev climbed the greasy pole to the position that then led him to Moscow, and we interviewed people, almost all of them, the first thing they said about Gorbachev was he was erudirovanny, erudite. And the second thing they all said was he treated his wife beautifully, very well, in contrast to all of the rest of them. So I think they promoted him because they saw in him what they had maybe originally hoped communism would produce, but were knowledgeable enough and cynical enough themselves to know often was not the result. I think there was a kind of nostalgia there. They had finally found the good man who could be the young, vigorous leader of their system and perhaps revive it.
In the way you portray Gorbachev, and I should say that your publisher describes the biography as a kind of Russian novel that one kind of lets oneself into. I'm thinking of Dostoevsky or Tolstoy. One gets the sense that even Gorbachev himself, as a character in maybe Dostoevsky, is unaware of the very forces that he has inside that will enable him to achieve what he's doing, and gets surprised by reaching the point that he does. And there are a variety of moments in the book that I liked very much, in which the tension between that corrupt environment that you're describing and the moral standing, the vision that he has, come into a clash. There's a moment when he gets the Nobel Prize at the very end where you describe him as psychologically very fragile. He gets visitors from the United States, and he is seen as vulnerable, as a reluctant to accept the prize. He, in the end, doesn't even go to receive the prize, procrastinates in delivering the speech. So I wonder if you saw a man who psychologically, and I go back to your first answer when talking about that course that you co-taught in psychology and biography, I wonder if you saw a man who was able to achieve this astonishing high and then was shaken by what he had accomplished and maybe psychologically brought down by it.
Well, first of all, I think he shied away from trying to dig too deeply into himself. There were several moments in his memoirs and in our conversations where I would ask him, "What were you thinking exactly about yourself?" And he sort of dismissed them with generalities, how human nature is difficult to probe and understand. So I think that is there. Now, the next question is, what is he afraid of discovering in himself that leads him to shrink back from that? Well, one response is that to ask that question in that way is making too much of it, because Bolshevik modesty was characteristic of all of them. They had to pretend to be modest even when they craved power and didn't want to give it up at any cost. But I think it's more than that. I think he was ambitious in a kind of way that was visible, and yet he didn't want to admit to himself. He strove to excel both as a child in school at Moscow University, in the Communist Party. As he rose, he prided himself on his being more educated and knowledgeable and intelligent than most of his colleagues. And I think that then translates to the other thing you were talking about, to his fragility later on. Because the essence of what happens is he begins this project of transforming his country and the world. And for a while, it looks as if he's going to succeed against all odds. He's going to take a country which has never known democracy in its centuries of existence, except perhaps for a few chaotic months in 1917. And he's going to turn it into something like Sweden, if he can succeed. By the way, that's not his goal from the beginning. It sort of evolves. But by the end, that's what he's trying to do. And he's ending the Cold War. And yet things don't go well. At the very peak of his success in 1989, when he has created free elections for the first time in Soviet history, he's created a genuine functioning parliament for the first time in Soviet history. The Cold War is in effect over by 1989. At that point, that's both the peak and the beginning of the decline, because by that point, the economic troubles that have deepened as a result of his economic reforms are showing their ugly face. By that point, he is losing political forces both to the left and the right. The communist hardliners are more and more unhappy with what he's doing, and the radical Democrats are more unhappy because they think he's going too slowly. And from then on, 1989 to 1991, it's in a sense it's downhill all the way. And I think what's happening psychologically is that he is realizing that despite his early success, this is turning into a potential disaster for his country and himself. And I think just because his hopes are so high for what he will accomplish, his distress is so great. And I think that makes him erratic where he used to be consistent. And it makes him fragile where he used to be strong. And to go back to the Nobel Prize example that you gave, this is a triumph in the world. But in his own country, an awful lot of his own people are saying, see, he sold out to the West, and now they're paying him off with this prize. And therefore, I describe a scene in which he's sitting there looking at his prize or looking at the designation of him as the Nobel laureate. But he also is looking at letters he's getting from rank-and-file Russians saying, you sold out, you bastard. And he is, as I describe him, although I wasn't there, and here's a case where I'm putting myself into it, I think he's sort of mesmerized by the contradiction that he could achieve the pinnacle, the Nobel Prize, and yet, in the eyes of his countrymen, be seen as selling out to get it.
Because at the heart of his quest, and I will bring here the adjective quixotic, at the heart of this very quixotic quest is not only to transform the political ecosystem that is in the Soviet Russia at the end of the 80s and beginning of the 90s, but to change the very metabolism, maybe, of how Russians go about dealing in political ways. The corruption, the traditional approach to the strong figure in power. And he is very strong, but his approach is to be also open and engaging dialogue. So there is a fool, just as in Don Quixote, there's a fool in him that is part of the dream.
Well, you know, obviously, Don Quixote better than I do. My impression is Don Quixote was more of a fool than Gorbachev. Don Quixote was tilting against windmills. Gorbachev was tilting against communist forces who ultimately carried out a coup against him. But there is this quixotic quest to accomplish a task that in retrospect is readily dismissed as impossible. He took on an impossible project and ran into the difficulties that obviously emerged. I wanted to pick up, if I may, on a couple of things you just said. Russians are indeed used to strong leaders and value them excessively in my Western view. And Gorbachev deliberately tried to appear, yes, strong, but it's interesting, among the things they hold against him that Russians say in retrospect that prove that he was a disaster, they say, for example, he listened. Can you imagine that? He listened. That's bad. That's very bad. Another thing they say is he changed his mind. Of course one wants a leader to listen, and it's natural to change one mind. But in Russian eyes, that's sort of proof positive that this guy was making a mess of things.
Part of the book, too, you talk about what happened with Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union and of Vladimir Putin and the relationship that the two have. It used to be closer for a while, and now they don't talk to one another. Gorbachev has suggested one or two things that Putin has ignored. Putin has said a few things in the press against Gorbachev. And yet, Gorbachev also has celebrated Putin in different aspects. I wonder if this is not also part of the same pendulum that we see in the United States, as different an ecosystem as that might be, from a person that listens and changes his mind, like Obama, although some people would say that he never listened and never changed his mind, to somebody that can be so autocratic and bullish and bullying, dictatorial and populist like Donald Trump, in the tension that one has between Gorbachev and Putin as well.
Well, if that's happening, and I think it is in the United States, I hope, here I'm revealing my own political preferences, that the pendulum will swing back and we'll get after Trump somebody who listens and is willing to change his mind. The problem with Russia is it may not happen. It probably won't happen, at least in the near future, because Russia is all too used to un-Gorbachevian behavior. If you look at the history of Russia and the Soviet Union and now post-Soviet Russia again, Gorbachev is the exception, and the strong authoritarian or totalitarian leader is the rule. As for Gorbachev's relationship with Putin, what has happened in effect is that Gorbachev has provided Putin with a program which is to do the opposite of what Gorbachev did. Gorbachev allowed free speech. Putin is closing it down. Gorbachev allowed a functioning parliament with real debate. Putin is taming the parliament, if not rigging the elections that produce it. Gorbachev made peace with the West. Putin is presiding over a new Cold War with the West. Now, given all of that, one might expect Gorbachev to be unremittingly critical of Putin. So what one has to explain is why he is not. Why he said, for example, when Putin came in the year 2000, in the beginning, Gorbachev said, a certain degree of authoritarianism is necessary in our country, or may be necessary. Well, I'm tempted to explain that by saying, first of all, after the Yeltsin years, because Gorbachev was no friend of Yeltsin, the Yeltsin years were chaotic. But it may also be that Gorbachev is reflecting in that comment the lesson he's learned, that his own effort to democratize Russia in a few years, that was too fast. And that would be then supported by the fact that later on Gorbachev said things like, it may take decades to democratize Russia. And he even went so far as to say at one point, it may take the whole 21st century. So I suppose, and here I'm speculating, that if that is his view, then a relatively mild form of authoritarianism, which in the beginning he thought Putin would represent, would be okay. What's happened over time is he's decided that Putin is not so mild an authoritarian, and therefore he's more critical.
I want to go briefly to the topic of the love that Gorbachev had for his wife, Raisa, and the deep impact that her death had on him. This is a love that came across in pop culture as much as it did in biographies like the one that you just produced. It is a love that not always happens in figures at the very high level of power, and that also makes Gorbachev an appealing, empathetic figure because of the power of that love.
You say it doesn't always happen at that level. I'm tempted to say it rarely happens, although God knows we don't know enough about what goes on among married couples who happen to be presidents and spouses. But Gorbachev, in that sense, as in many others, for example, his allergy to using force, was an extraordinarily decent man. It came out in his relationship with his wife, to whom he was so devoted, in his relationship with his daughter, to whom he was devoted, and to his granddaughters. And yet, when his wife died of leukemia in 1999, he said, I am guilty. I am the one who did her in. And I've seen interviews with him at that time in which he looks totally stricken. As I think about it and try to understand those words, I think he was saying she turned out to be not temperamentally suited for the role that she played of Soviet First Lady. We know that she was, in effect, the first modern Soviet First Lady. The previous ones had looked like tea cozies, and they had never appeared or rarely appeared in public anyway. But she was elegant. She was educated. She was intelligent. She was stylish. And she strode the world with him, partly to protect him. That's very important to realize. She went with him everywhere, even after she became ill. So if it turned out, as I think it did, that she was not suited, that she was too sensitive, that she couldn't stand the attacks on him which accumulated over the years, which he didn't like either, but he sort of brushed them off and continued on. If she was like that, then in a sense, I think that's what he meant. And the terrible moment, I think the most terrible moment in this regard, is that in 1996, after he'd been out of power for 5 years, there was an election in which the two main candidates were Yeltsin and the communist leader Gennady Zyuganov. Gorbachev decided to run for president. She told him not to. His closest advisors urged him not to, but he insisted. In the end, he got less than 1% of the vote. But he campaigned tirelessly in 20 cities over 2 or 3 months. Some of these occasions were horrible. There was one case where somebody spat in his face, another case where he was slapped across the face. He was denied halls to speak in that he had been promised. And I knew this was horrible, both the process and the result. I had not realized until I was writing about this that she had insisted on accompanying him everywhere, even though in 1991, during the coup, she'd had a stroke from which she had never fully recovered. And we don't know whether leukemia was already forming, from which she would die in 1999. And one more thing that's part of this tragic picture, she had urged him to resign much earlier, saying, "You've accomplished everything you wanted to. Let's retire to a cottage by the sea." And he couldn't bring himself to do it. And he, of course, would say his job wasn't finished and that he ran, you know, for office and president in 1996 because the others were unacceptable and he wanted to continue preaching his gospel. But in that sense, he did do her in, I suppose, and he was right to admit it.
There is a part of the book that is indeed like a Russian novel. It seems to me it's the relationship between the two that is incredibly moving and affectionate. There are two Gorbachevs. One comes to the conclusion after reading your book, or many more, but summarizing, the Gorbachev inside Russia, despised figure that is seen as having brought down the power, and then the Gorbachev of the outside, the figure, the democratizer, the open-hearted and open-minded figure, strong but vulnerable. It seems to me that there is, even in the West, a kind of bipolar approach to him. If I think of Gorbachev, I'm not a Soviet specialist in any way, just a follower of life in Russia and the rise and fall of the Soviet Empire. It seems to me that one can compare him, though there are enormous differences, with figures like Mandela, for instance, who brought down an entire system. Very different because Mandela spent a long time in jail. Mandela was a moral figure. Mandela was even biblical, whereas Gorbachev was much more of a Politburo leader. But in the West, and I think your book is bringing him back, he's not mentioned as often as a major leader.
Gorbachev.
I'm talking mainly about popular culture, obviously, in political circles and in diplomacy, the size and scope of him. So I wonder if even in the West, there is not a sense of the man did not live up to, or the man is less than we all want to think him of. And why is, in your view, Gorbachev not presented as a titanic, totemic figure, like Mandela or even like Obama or figures of that size, but instead seen as kind of the catalyst that brought down the empire and then kind of pushed aside?
That's a wonderful question, very complex, and I hope I can give a complex answer that it merits. First of all, the comparison with somebody like Mandela, yes, indeed. We haven't talked much about the fact that Gorbachev shunned as much as possible the use of force. He did use force, for example, when there were pogroms in Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan, and Armenians were being slaughtered. He finally agreed to send in troops, and a lot of people were killed. A similar instance in Tbilisi, the capital of Soviet Georgia. Troops were sent in, but it seems quite clear in retrospect he did not send them in. At one point, I interviewed one of his close collaborators who said, damn it, he should have, in the case of some of these pogroms, he should have arrested these people, he should have hung them from lampposts in the Caucasus, because if he had done that, the Baltics, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, might have hesitated to break away. So in his own country, this is one of the main charges against him, that he didn't use force to protect the freedom that he had created. That non-use of force reminds us of Mandela. It even reminds us, if we want to go that far, of Gandhi. But Gorbachev is not celebrated. I suppose it's partly because he did a lot of other things, which even in the West people look at. I interviewed some American leaders who dealt with him. I don't want to name them in this particular case, but I sensed it in one case, a man who had negotiated with him a great deal. I sensed that he had come to think of Gorbachev as a man who couldn't shut up. He talked too much. He went on and on. He kept talking of visions rather than the cold realities that diplomats needed to deal with. For the first 3 or 4 years of his reign or his rule, Gorbachev was extremely popular. in the Soviet Union, that it was only later, as things disintegrated, that he became criticized as fiercely as he was. So there's that. But there's one other reason, I think, right now why he is not paid more attention, even when, in Arthur Miller's phrase, attention must be paid. And that is that Trump has sucked up all the air and that Putin has sucked up whatever other air. This sounds like special pleading, but my publisher had assumed that when this book came out, that NPR and PBS and, you know, television would want to talk about it. But they really haven't. In that sense, you're the exception, for which I am very grateful and admire you. Gorbachev has become yesterday's news. And that's perhaps because he was so newsworthy at the time. That is, he still is news, but he's yesterday's news.
Finally, Bill, I want to ask you this question. In the East and West, in the in and out of the character that you have chosen, you come from the out. You come from the United States. You are offering a vision of Gorbachev that results from what used to be the opponent's cradle, so to speak. You were talking a few minutes ago about the biography coming out soon in Russia, at which point he will be able to read it. Isn't even the fact that the biography will come from the outside, that it will be translated from the English into Russian, that Professor Taubman teaches in the West, already a de facto discrediting element for Russians to look at this book with a clear and balanced eyes?
That may well be the case. In the case of my Khrushchev biography, the Russian publisher resorted to asking a member of the Russian Academy of Sciences to write a foreword, in effect vouching for me. This time, I don't think there will be such a foreword, and I don't know how much that foreword to the Khrushchev biography helped it to be accepted. It sold a lot of copies by Russian standards, and I've had a couple of people tell me in the Russian Academy and otherwise, they regard it as the definitive biography of Khrushchev. Now, whether that will happen in this case, I don't know. But I do know that there was no other good biography of Khrushchev in the Soviet Union, and there is no, though there is one. There's a wonderful short biography of Gorbachev by one of his former associates. But that raises an interesting question as to why Russians don't write these biographies themselves. Why didn't they do it before I came along? I think the answer is partly that these subjects are so controversial and so much debated, and the debate is so heated, that it probably looks to people who might imagine themselves writing an objective biography as if that's impossible. It's either pro or con. But there's something else that I think is more general, and that is the legacy of Marxism. It's a paradox that the Soviet Union, claiming to be Marxist, and hence subject to the Marxist conclusion that impersonal economic forces determine history, ended up with leaders who determine history more than in most countries. Lenin. Without Lenin, they wouldn't have seized power in the first place. Without Stalin, they wouldn't have had these purges on a scale that defies belief. Without Khrushchev, they wouldn't have denounced Stalin. He was the one who did it. And without Gorbachev, the effort to transform this country wouldn't have taken place when and how it did. So the irony, this grand irony, is that this country, whose leaders have been so important to its history, don't get their biographies written until an American comes along and tries to do it.
It's been extraordinary to have you in the show. It's a wonderful book. Thank you.
Thank you for your wonderful questions. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
H.L. Mencken, the great American journalist, thought that as democracy is perfected, the leader represents more and more closely the inner soul of the people. Mencken's idea is enticing on two fronts. One, that a nation's leader can come to represent the inner soul of the people. And two, that democracy can be perfected. Mikhail Gorbachev, the last leader of the Soviet Union, is proof that Mencken was wrong, at least in part. Gorbachev did something that to this day seems impossible. He pushed for reform in a system, communism, that was built on predicating equality, yet was known for its steadfast resistance to individual freedom. He believed that democracy could be implemented in Russia, that leaders should be chosen in elections, and that there should be an open and uncensored press. And that free speech shouldn't be the purview of Western civilization. At first sight, Gorbachev succeeded. But his success gave place to retrenchment. Today, Russia is utterly undemocratic. Its leader, Vladimir Putin, is a tyrant enamored with his own image and convinced that Russia's only road to the future is with him at the helm. Where Mencken was right is that, at least on the surface, Putin seems to represent the inner soul of the people. Is it fair to say that individual freedom and Russia are mutually exclusive? We live in an age in which the word disruption is embraced as an antidote to routine. Gorbachev is a superb case study of a 20th century disruption. He broke apart the Soviet bloc in ways that still seem inconceivable. Yet aside from a handful of specialists in world diplomacy, few remember him. His policies are seen as exceptional. Maybe we only embrace disruption when it is connected with radicalism, not with common sense. Maybe democracy, the least imperfect of all systems of government, isn't for everyone. Maybe the inner soul of people is impulsive and unpredictable and dislikes debate. Next time on In Contrast.
The difference between adults and kids is not that they're dumber. It's just that kids are newer.
Mo Williams, next time on In Contrast. Let us know what you think about In Contrast. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send us an email to radio@nepr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook, where we invite you to share your comments on this program and others in our series. Our interns are Jacob Pagano and Delina Hadgu. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. I'm Ilan Stavans. Thank you for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.